Hello, Hyrule! Welcome back to the premier Legend of Zelda Travelogue podcast. We are your tour guides. My name is Pete.
And my name's Chris. Hey, Pete.
How's it going?
Before we started recording, you and I were talking about Mass Effect for like a solid half hour because I recently restarted playing the trilogy and it's been a ton of fun.
Oh, yeah.
And it got me thinking about, you know, what I like about RPGs and the different classes and the differences between, you know, different characters you can make.
Okay.
And bringing it back to Zelda, I know Zelda RPGs are something you've spent a lot of time thinking about.
Oh, yeah, all the time. Like video games, tabletop, yeah, tons.
And I was wondering, I have a real simple question for you this episode. If they were to finally make a Zelda game that was fully embracing the fact that it's an RPG.
Okay.
And you don't play Link, you play different characters throughout the franchise. What is one pairing of race and class that you would see in pre-release material and be like, yes, that's it. That's what I would want to be.
Class being like in D&D, like your Final Fantasy job system?
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy, that's a tough, because like just to you know, put cards on the table here, I have actually very slowly in the background been trying to cobble together a Zelda tabletop RPG.
Mm-hmm.
It's very slow going, but I'm feeling pretty good about what I have so far.
Yeah, I've seen it, and it's awesome to see you build.
I've actually done my best to not include a class system for the reason that, like, I feel like that is kind of antithetical to what Zelda is. You know what I mean?
Okay, well,
because otherwise, what are we looking at? You got like, oh, this is your bomb user class. This is your, like, wield a magic rod class.
Come on, have a little fun here.
I mean, I'll play in your space.
There you
okay,
go.
So my favorite that I would want to do,
mm-hmm.
I think I would want to play as either a Gerudo or a Deku Scrub.
Ooh,
big or small. That's where I'm going. But like, as far as a class, I don't know what would fit. I guess like, if you could get a Tinkerer class in there at some point, like a Deku Scrub Tinkerer.
That's
like
fun.
I can make different kinds of bombs. I get like a Sheikah Slate or something.
Interesting. I like that.
What are you thinking?
I was thinking a Zora Bard could be fun.
Oh, okay. So you're literally talking about D&D classes.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I'm also literally talking about characters in Majora's Mask.
Oh, I guess, yeah, Macaw is kind of a bard, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Hmm. I think it could be fun, especially when you think about the Zora, their relationship with Rito, and then some mm-hmm. of the musician Rito that you see later in the series.
That could be interesting if you play with it that way, where it's like, you know, because music is kind of a big thing in Zelda, or at least in certain games, mm-hmm. where like if your whole thing is just having a repertoire of different songs you can play.
Oh, yeah.
That could be cool.
The way some Final Fantasy games have fully embraced letting you make music as a bard, like Final Fantasy 14 has a totally wild bard music system. They let you play notes and build songs. It's just it's totally wild.
Huh. Well, that sounds kind of neat. You'll have to tell me about that later.
Yeah,
when we're not recording our Legend of Zelda Travelogue podcast.
Well, speaking of our Legend of Zelda Travelogue podcast, Pete, do you have a recap of where we are in the game right now?
Oh, brother. Well, we were on Mount Krennel inside the dungeon known as the Cave of Flames.
Ooh.
We fought a ton of new kinds of monsters. We became flip wizards in our own right, and we fought a giant turtle Lugia bone creature in lava, which we killed.
Flip Wizard has real 90s attitude energy.
It's a term that I first heard on some McElroy podcast. I can't recall which one. It was probably Adventure Zone. I just fell in love with it. It's one of my favorite terms.
It's a good term. And we got back to Malari's mine and we had the white sword waiting for us, right?
Yes, sir. It's cool that we got this. We're only going to have it for a little bit, though, because we're going to be upgrading it throughout the game.
Yep. As soon as we get it, Malari tells us to bring it to the elemental sanctuary and start infusing these elements that we've been collecting up to this point.
Mm-hmm. I think the only hint we get is that it's in Hyrule Castle.
Yeah.
Possibly Malari doesn't know anything more than that.
I mean, why would he? It's not like Minish have free reign to just explore the castle. Though actually, they probably could. Like, who would know, right?
Exactly.
Anyway, so that's our next destination. We're going back to Hyrule and back into Hyrule Castle to find the elemental sanctuary. So what is the Elemental Sanctuary? The Elemental Sanctuary is this gateway, they call it, between the Minish Realm and Hyrule, right?
Yes. Here's the thing. Eslo phrases it in the game as, like, I have a direct quote right here. In a ham sandwich, great start, good start. The Elemental Sanctuary would be the ham between the two slices of bread.
Wow. Why even try to come up with a different metaphor? That's the perfect one right there.
It kind of fits this show perfectly, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
In this game, the terms Minish World or, like, Minish Realm are used sort of interchangeably.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it refers to this world beyond the Elemental Sanctuary, but also just, like, the tiny corners of Hyrule where the Minish occupy. You know what I mean?
Are you technically in the Minish Realm when you're shrinking? Because it's every 100 years they kind of come out of that realm.
Well, exactly.
Right? They exit this door and they're in our realm.
That's part of what's got me confused, Chris.
Right. So they're in our realm. The Minish Realm is a separate realm going through this door, I've got to imagine, right?
Uh-huh.
There's this door, there's the Ham Sandwich Sanctuary, and then there's the Minish Realm.
And every 100 years, the ham sandwich opens.
Yeah.
And you can crawl inside it.
Right, right.
But here's the other thing, Chris. Is the Minish Realm the same as the Sacred Realm?
I think it's supposed to be... So I don't think so. I think
no.
I think it's this... games developers creating a parallel to the sacred, what would be the sacred realm in most traditional Zelda games without actually creating the sacred realm.
Well, here's, I guess, the third thing. The Picori or the Minish in the intro of the game, they're described as like having come down from the sky, right?
Mm-hmm.
They came from the sky with a magic sword and this golden light that saved the day, etc., etc. But their realm, their world is on the ground. Behind a door.
Right.
So what's the through line there? I'm thinking, this is just my theory, Chris, that this iteration of Hyrule Castle was built on top of the sealed grounds in Skyward Sword. The reason being, underneath the goddess statue is Sky Keep, right? The last dungeon in Skyward Sword.
Mm-hmm. Which is where the Sacred Realm is?
Where you can access the Sacred Realm.
Okay.
And that's where they hid away the Triforce for a long time, you know, and it makes sense to me.
Okay, so you're saying the Minish Realm is clearly where the Minish are kind of holding the Triforce or the holding the Light Force, whatever.
If the Triforce is there, I think honestly that the Triforce is just inside of Link and Zelda right now. That's
okay. Fair. Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that's a fun way to connect these things for sure. I see where you're going.
If that's the case.
I don't know that there's enough in here to explicitly state that. But
yeah.
It could certainly be like they're leaving some pieces missing for you to kind of fill in, you know, the gaps your own way. And
I think it's just completely incidental that these pieces link together in any way that resembles a theory. But it's one that I like.
And this is exactly why we wanted to do the show like this, is so that we can piece these small things together and make these connections, whether or not they're really connections that are there.
Right.
I think it's a logical connection to make in regards to this world and how it might have evolved over time.
Right.
Anyway, bringing us back to the real world right now, Link and Eslo are heading to Hyrule Castle. Eslo makes a small remark. Are you sure I look all right? I never know what to wear in these occasions, which I guess...
What?
He's a hat.
He's cracking a joke, right?
He's cracking a joke because
okay.
He's a bird hat. He's never done this as a bird hat, I've got to imagine.
I have to ask, though. I have to ask that question because, like, he's also a weird old man.
He is. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So we head west through the castle, through a nice, like, elongated garden area that's kind of reminiscent of where you first meet Princess Zelda in Ocarina of Time. So we head through that garden, and there's, like, just this large blue door at the end of it.
I do have a question about this spot, because it is clearly, like, a garden or a tiny courtyard kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is this open to the elements, or is there a roof over this? This is kind of like the basement. Almost.
I don't remember if the stairs are up or down. I think this is open. I think this is, again, in my mind, this is like in N64 where it's open roof.
I mean, I'm game for that. It looks better in cutscenes, so.
Certainly. And so there is a, like I mentioned, there's a big blue door here. Eslo makes a comment about how only Link and Eslo could see it. So it's a glowing door only visible to pure of heart children, and Minish. So we enter the elemental sanctuary, and this was like a really interesting transitional hallway, because like we go from the garden into what feels like a giant blue cavern with massive crystals sticking out of the floor.
Sort of, yeah. It's also, it's kind of got like this very almost like Zen crystal cathedral kind of energy to it.
Yeah, like I said, it's kind of transitionary. It kind of comes and goes. The main focus of this part is this pedestal room.
A much larger room than it needs to be.
Much larger.
Like, yeah. You'd think there'd be something going down in here at some point where it really does... You don't fight anything in here.
No, there's nothing hostile about this area. At least not right now. I think you come back here towards the end of the game, and that's where some bad stuff happens.
You come back a couple times.
Oh, yeah.
I did think... Because there's also these kind of weird, like, geometric... polygonal Minish knight statues in here. At least I thought, I mean, I got the impression that they were Minish.
Yes.
And what I thought, Chris, is that once you went up to this sword pedestal up here, the center of the room, that they would come to life and you have to fight.
We're not Minish size though, coming here, right? Like,
right.
That's the interesting thing. So like those would just be like dark nuts,
I guess.
Right? Because they're kind of the same size as Link.
Yeah. I mean, they could be potentially larger than him, too. But either way, you'd be fighting, like, automatons made of crystal, and that's not great.
It would be kind of a cool fight, though.
I'll have to keep that in mind for my next D&D campaign.
Just visually, this room is very much like the shrine at the Sealed Grounds in Skyward Sword.
In what regard?
It's just a blue abandoned shrine, to some extent, right? There's a pedestal here.
Okay.
That clearly some stuff's going to happen when you plug the sword into the pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it's just got a very relaxed, serene vibe to it.
That would also make me wonder, if I could link this to my theory from a few minutes ago.
What was your theory a few minutes ago? Connect the dots.
Okay. Well, so proposing that underneath Hyrule Castle is the Sealed Grounds. Yes?
Sure.
If we accept that to be the case, then it would make sense that this area here would also be a part of that, right? Because it's like right nearby.
Oh, okay. Actually, I like that.
That was more or less it. I could get more detailed, but I think you get the gist.
Okay, so where that kind of falls apart is Skyward Sword was released 5 years after this game or something.
Well, but hang on.
I know, that's no fun.
How many times this season have we talked about how Skyward Sword was kind of based on stuff that was seen in Minish Cap?
Yeah. Okay, if this sanctuary is what inspired Sealed Grounds, that's one of the coolest things they've done in Skyward Sword. Probably.
It's pretty good. I mean, honestly, just tack a whole other castle on top of this temple that you walked into. You're done.
So we have a pedestal in the center of the room here. We have some flashy tiles on the ground. We'll get to those in just a second. We put the sword in the pedestal. The powers of earth and fire just kind of make their way to the two of the four stands.
You send your candies onto the pedestals, and that, for some reason, I just thought of this, you're putting that energy into the pedestal in this room, so it's no longer in the sword, right?
No, you watch it. You watch it go into the sword.
But you carried it here in the sword.
Okay.
Didn't you?
No, you carried... No. We carried these elements as physical objects separate from the sword,
oh,
I believe.
Oh, okay.
So what happens, and this is kind of a cool visual thing that I didn't really notice too much until rewatching for this episode, but, like, you see once the two elements start getting transferred into the sword in this little scene here, you see, like, a purple version of this sword when the earth power, which is purple, gets infused into it, and then you see the red and gold version of the sword once the fire version gets infused into it.
Right.
So it's like every element alters this sword to make it a different color.
Sure. That makes sense to me.
We don't really get any time with that cool purple variant, but that purple variant's very reminiscent of the standard Master Sword, I thought, right? Because you got that purple hilt.
Kinda, yeah. I mean, I don't think that the Pickery Blade and the Master Sword are the same sword.
No. It just has that look to it for a second. A tablet comes down from the sky, and it tells us to fill our sword with power while standing on one of these tiles and let it go while standing on a separate nearby tile, essentially.
There's a lot for me to unpack here. If you are accustomed to how my brain works.
I just want to say, how funny is it that it's like the goddess is watching Link from the mm-hmm. sky, and every now and then writes a little note on a paper airplane, which is really a tablet in this world, and mm-hmm. chucks it to Link,
uh-huh.
almost crushing anything that's nearby Link.
Crashes through Hyrule Castle, through every floor to land down here.
Just to tutorialize mechanics.
She lost the ability to talk to you in text boxes like in the first game, mm-hmm. and now she has to send physical evidence.
I love it. Anyway, do you want to start unpacking some of this?
Chris, you just gotta love ancient texts that are purely video game instruction.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing else on this ancient slab that appeared by magic apart from video game instructions, Chris?
It's like if when you read the Holy Bible, there were sections of it that were like, put your clothes in the laundry machine, and then you fill the cap uh-huh. up with half of the detergent, but don't fill it up too much, and then you right. put the detergent in the laundry machine.
Yeah. If it had like a very specific sequence of things, like walk 10 paces north and then turn to your right and walk 13 paces this way, like it's a treasure map.
Yeah, it's just like in this moment, you have Ezla right there, who could kind of probably find a way to naturally state this thing.
He's the guy who reads it, so maybe he's boiling it down for you?
Oh, maybe. Or maybe. Wait. Better yet, what if he has no idea what it says? And he is just putting on a complete front.
He already knows how it works. He doesn't have to
read it. He knows how this works, yeah. Meanwhile, we have no idea what the goddess is trying to tell us.
Which, I mean, if it's the goddess, because if it's true what Ezla is saying, that this is like Minish language, then how come we can't read it? Like, does the Jabbernut not let us read Minish? We can only speak it?
Yeah, we already talked about it, right? Nuts in this game just are for mouth stuff.
Chris, no. We can't.
I didn't really think about that one before.
I have to disagree. I think that was premeditated, sir.
Anyway, so we notice these two glowing tiles just south of us. We do as this tablet says. We charge up a charged shot. We walk over to the first tile. We get like a little sound cue,
mm-hmm.
like a weird, like, I don't
Schwing.
Even... And then we walk over to the second tile, and then we get the... And then there's two links.
There's two links who both go hya-hya twice.
A tale of two boys.
You can probably guess, this, considering there's two more elements left, that you're going to get two more links after this point.
And here you go.
And maybe you're wondering. And the answer is yes. When you have four links, they do go hya-hya, hya-hya. In order.
I'm sure that's the first thing everyone is wondering when we say there's two links.
It gets, honestly, it's a little oppressive.
So we do this Link splits in two, which is the power of the white sword, right? And we've spoken about how Four Swords and Four Swords Adventures mm-hmm. are in this game's story. They are sequels to this game story-wise, narrative-wise, even if they predated this game.
They made a whole video game just to explain why there's multiplayer in two titles.
They did, essentially. I gotta say, this is like kind of one of the least interesting things about this game to me.
It does feel a little forced, right? It's a little weird.
It's just like sometimes you'll need four links to push a thing. There's one boss fight that utilizes this in just the coolest way in the world. I will say that one boss fight later on mm-hmm. redeems kind of a lot of the boring puzzles along the way.
It feels good.
Yeah.
For once. This, I mean, most of the time though, like, just get ready for like a lot of puzzles out there in the world that have no logical explanation for needing like a Tetris block made of boys.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, you'll see a bunch of these tiles, and then you'll see some holes in the wall in a very particular way, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess we should explain this for a second. When you make that second link, or down the line, you'll make a third and a fourth link, as uh-huh. Pete mentioned, your links will always be that many spaces apart from each other.
Yeah, they're locked in place, in position.
Right. So you need to navigate with the links kind of in that formation. And if any of the boys touch a wall or get hit by an enemy, mm-hmm. all of the clones will disappear.
Minus regular Link.
Minus regular Link.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's the real one. The other ones are like holograms, I guess. And so they can't pass through matter.
Are they hologram? Like, so that's cool. To be honest, I kind of appreciate the fact that they gave some pre-lore to games that they created previously.
Uh-huh.
But like, they're not holograms in those games, right? Those are very corporeal Links.
Yeah, extremely real. Like, and they are color coded, which they are not in this game.
Right. I like that. I love me a color coded Link.
Oh, honestly, yeah, me too. It's pretty cool. But like, so even though this is a prequel to Four Swords / Four Swords Adventures, two different games, it does not explain why that happens, like how this sword changes over time. So like,
right,
the whole mechanic, the whole reason that they put this in the game is not fully explained.
Not really, but it's explained enough. The Force Sword has the ability to make many Links,
which are, I guess, made from the elements. So right now we've got Wind Link, who is Link Prime. And we have the second one, which is Fire Link.
Fire Link should be Link Prime.
I don't know. He's always been kind of associated with wind in all the games, right?
Has he been? Because of the Kokiri stuff?
Just thematically, there's Kokiri stuff, there's Wind Waker, there's, you know, he usually gets some kind of wind item of some kind.
Okay, you got me there.
It's all just Shadow Clone Jutsu, and like, it has no real substance, but that's okay.
So we're going to come back here a few times, as Pete mentioned, to infuse the next two elements. We'll probably just breeze by those moments in future episodes. Is there anything else you want to tackle while we're here?
I think it's a pretty cool, chill place. I had kind of hoped there'd be like a proper dungeon down here with this aesthetic. That'd be pretty fun.
That would be. There is a cool little Triforce at the bottom of the sanctuary that just realizing now in my screenshots.
Sure. It's that's where they, you know, because this is where they used to hold the Triforce, Chris. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but this version of it has these interesting little swirls within it instead of just being triangular.
It's barely a Triforce, now that I'm looking at
it. It's a triangle.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is what happens after podcasting about The Legend of Zelda for a full calendar year, is sometimes you see a triangle and your brain says, oh, a Triforce. That's not what that is, bud.
It could be worse. We could, you know, be seeing Illuminati eyes everywhere.
I guess so. We're going to get to some of those eyes in a few episodes. Oh,
everything kind of like connects weirdly with this stuff.
It does. But for now, we're going to head back to North Hyrule Field, where we get a fun little cutscene. Link is confronted by Vati here. Vati says, interesting, you're the last person I expected to find here. And just as I was wondering who could be behind this, I find my old master.
Dun, dun, dun. Is he here? Is Vati here during this scene? I don't remember. I thought he was like a disembodied voice.
Yeah, no, Vati teleports in front of Link.
Okay.
And then, you know, Eslo screams out Vati's name. Vati takes a dig at your clothes. He says, as always, you're dressed in the shabbiest of rags.
He's making fun of Eslo's clothes, saying he's dressed in the shabbiest of rags, but are we a rag? Are we the rag?
He's saying that Eslo is wearing Link, which is a fun little...
I guess.
He essentially says, my curses are not to be mocked. The one I cast on you is most powerful. No matter what power you wield, you will never break it. So he's talking directly to Eslo there.
So Vati turned Eslo into a hat.
Vati turned Eslo, his old master, into a hat. Eslo says, you haven't changed in the slightest. I should have never created that cap. It only fueled your insane desires.
Now, here's the twist. Is the Minish Cap in the title, is that Eslo? Or is the Minish Cap the one we're about to talk about?
That's a good point. Do they ever call one of them the Minish Cap?
Nope.
That's very fun. I never really stopped and thought about that. I've got to imagine it's the one that Vati's wearing.
It could be. Well, okay, let's, because we're, I apologize for sidetracking us there. So we find out in a flashback cutscene, which I think is when Eslo is explaining the situation to us.
Mm-hmm.
That when Eslo was a Minish and he was Vati's master, that he had made a cap, like a red dunce hat. You get a look at it for a second.
Mm-hmm.
That grants wishes to the wearer of the cap. And Vati, being like a sourpuss forever, apparently, he just steals the hat and makes a wish that he's like the greatest sorcerer that ever lived, something, something, something. Ezlo tries to stop him, and Vati turns him into a hat because comedy, I guess.
Guess so. I love this little scene here. This is, you see both Ezlo and Vati pre-corruption, I guess. Vati is this cute little Minish. He's a little purple Minish. He does have red glowing eyes, which is a red flag.
Yeah.
Should Although, be a red flag.
I did get the impression that he might just be albino, that which is fine, but like the fact that he's the only one and the villain is not great.
And yeah, this hat is like three sizes too big for him. This hat is very large. We learned a second prior to this cutscene that Vati mentions that this hat grants the wishes of its wearer a spectacular creation. So essentially it's the Dragon Balls.
Sort of, yeah. Like similar to how the Triforce is Dragon Balls.
Yeah, I guess so, huh? And Vati says, thanks to you, I've gone from being a meek, minuscule nothing to the greatest sorcerer alive. You cannot stop me now, and I have you to thank for it.
So did Vati have confidence issues?
I guess so. I mean, he just didn't believe in himself. Maybe he had a little bit of imposter syndrome.
Some guys will make a wish to become the world's greatest sorcerer instead of going to therapy.
Ezlo has a little bit of dialogue where he says that foul Vati, what could he be scheming? Vati and I are both Minish. I once was a famous sage and a renowned Minish craftsman. Vati was only a boy when I took him on as my apprentice, but he became enchanted by the wickedness in the hearts of men. And that's when he took the hat. So he basically saw, you know, Minish are very nice, goody-two-shoe, kind of warm to each other. But they also explore the world of man. And he saw some edgelord out there and thought, yeah.
He saw the box art for Sonic Adventure 2 and was like, yes, that's what I want.
He heard the Hurdy-Gurdy Man's Limp Bizkit album and was like, yes. And when that hat was created, that hat is a metaphor for Fred Durst's red hat.
I don't remember anything about Fred Durst or his red hat.
Anyway, so Vati puts on, you know, in this cutscene flashback, Vati puts on the red hat, which we are under the impression now that is the Minish cap, the Dragon Balls, the Triforce hat.
I guess.
Wishes that he could embody a stronger sorcerer, and I guess also the wickedness of man? I don't know. Choose a lane, dude.
I'm confused on his motivation here, because, like, the way he talks gives me the impression that, like, he was slighted or hurt somehow by humans and he wanted to conquer their world. But, like, we never get any sort of insight to that.
It says he was enchanted by the wickedness in the hearts of men. So it's almost like
he liked the bad stuff.
Yeah, he liked the bad stuff.
But he also wants to hurt humans, though.
I guess so, because he starts making them all stone, huh?
Yeah, but, like, he didn't even bother with conquering the Minish world first.
No, he went straight for that sword.
He's like, okay, I'm here. I'm big now. I'm going to enter a sword fighting tournament. And, you know, I have a very elaborate plan to go look at a sword.
He's a rambunctious kid. They don't really come up with long-term plans. They kind of just get in a mood and go for a thing, right?
He's kind of, I don't know if that makes me like Vati more or less.
He's a good, like, character design for a 2D Zelda. Like, in the same way that he's kind of a non-conventional. He's not a Ganon, right? We said the same thing about...
I mean, he might show up in about as much games as Ganondorf.
Yeah, I guess so, right?
Yeah, maybe. I could be, like, off by one or two games.
All right, so anyway, we see him put the hat on. We get this brief moment in between cute little Picori Vati and edgy emo Vati, where we see a version of Vati that is reminiscent of a boss fight we'll encounter later on. Where, let me show you this. I completely forgot about seeing this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you get this little, like, standing bipedal bat creature that made of shadows but has a, like, Millennium Puzzle eye on it, if you're familiar with Yu-Gi-Oh!
Yeah, it's a blink and you'll miss moment, but it's cool to see this, you know, coming back to it. Ezlo says, oh, what a vile form you've taken. Which, honestly, Vati is just, like, I forget the optional character's name, Magnus. from Chrono Trigger.
Oh, Magus.
Magus. Yeah, he's essentially Magus.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent, I mean, I feel like Vati pictures himself as that sort of stoic character, when instead he's just like a little boy in the body of such a creature. So he's like Tom Hanks in Big kind of situation. It's like, I'm gonna go drink a cigarette. I'm gonna do adult things.
Yes, absolutely. Although, you know what? We aren't giving him a lot of credit. And in one of these lines right here, Ezlo says, why Vati? What are you plotting? And Vati says, this year, on the day that comes but once a century, the portal opens, and when it does, I shall claim the light force as my own. I will be transformed, perfect, and there will be none who can stop me. So he does have a plan.
He thinks he has a plan. I don't think he has a plan.
Well, right now, his plan is to fling this big orb at Ezlo, transforming him from this sort of elven-looking Minish with long white hair and a cane.
It looks like a Minish.
He looks like a Minish, transforming him into the bird hat Ezlo that we know and love.
No, can't even say it with a straight face.
Vati then says, tell me, how does it feel? My sorcerer's curse. Do you see, Ezlo? I am truly your master now, and you cannot stop me.
I'm going to teach you how to drink a cigarette.
And with that, I must be leaving. And then we cut back to present day.
I don't know how to feel about Vati. I think he's kind of neat, and I like the idea of like an angry and confused child in the body of an adult. That's kind of neat, but like, I don't think you'd get a lot of mileage out of that.
I mean, it's a cool idea. Like, not everything has to be a world-ending situation that Hyrule's in. This is like, got a bit too angsty, a bit too powerful, and just needs to be taken care of, and that's what Link is set out to do this time.
Sure.
I'm kind of into it in that regard.
Yeah, that makes sense. He, you know, he has some lucky breaks, but he's really not that equipped to be a villain, I don't think.
No. So at this point, Ezlo is saying to us, those gifts that the Picori gave the humans, the Picori blade was one of them. And the second one, well, you can call it the Light Force. It's a source of limitless magical power. And if Vati were to get it now, it would be devastating.
So
that's the Triforce. The hat was the Triforce, and the Light Force is the Triforce.
Is the Triforce in the hat?
Are the Dragon Balls in the hat?
Are the Dragon Balls in the hat? Did they put the Dragon Balls in the Dragon Ball hat, Chris? That's what I want to know.
No, because he has the hat and he's looking for the Dragon Balls.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. All right. That makes sense.
So Ezlo says, if Vati were to get it now, that would be devastating. I came to the world of men hoping to stop Vati, and I met you in the woods. It seems we won't be breaking the curse on me anytime soon. However, with the sacred blade, we can certainly restore Princess Zelda. I'm sorry. All that has happened has been due to my own pride, my folly. I must rely on you, on your power, until we've put an end to Vati. Well, Link, enough fairy tales. We must search for the next element.
I don't know, man. I kind of want to blame Ezlo for this, like for not having the foresight with his apprentice's attitude, but like, I don't know. He just kind of assumed that this little bratty kid would mellow out at some point as he grew up, but he didn't do that, and he stole... You know what? Actually, why did you make a magic wish-granting hat, you doofus? Why did you do that?
First off, it's incredible that he would have been able to make all of that in a hat, but to play devil's advocate, he probably should have locked that hat up, because if not Vati, it was only a matter of time before some other villainous creature would have found it.
It was just sitting around.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he should feel as bad as he feels in this moment, but
he's not blameless.
This is a little bit his fault. Yeah. Anyway, so we are going to search for the next element. We're on our way to the Western Wood, where we get this dialogue from Ezlo, where he says, what a strange feeling. I sense something from the castle's direction, or was it just me? And then we cut to this cutscene in the castle.
Is this before or after Vati makes us fight a moblin?
Vati made us fight a moblin a long time ago.
Are you serious?
You cut to the past and skip right over.
We need to talk about that, Chris.
So before Ezlo's little moment of shame, it is worth noting that Vati traps us in a gate that he conjured into existence with two moblin.
Yes, with two like Wind Waker style spear moblin.
I love this moblin design. Is this the first time we're talking about moblins?
In this game, yeah.
I guess we should spend a second talking about them.
I mean, they're like huge, beefy cartoon pigmen, like that are still pirate themed from Wind Waker.
Yeah. I think this is a great Moblin design.
No, it's solid.
It transfers well to the 2D look as well.
Now, the reason I wanted to bring this up, Chris, and I'm sorry for distracting from the plot here.
No worries.
But, like, so Vati has the ability to conjure Moblins, right?
Mm-hmm.
He did that. He made the Moblins show up.
I mean,
when Bokoblins and Moblins are usually attributed to Ganon, right? So, like, is Vati kind of like, is he able to tap into malice in some way?
So I think this is a result of breaking the seal on that treasure chest in the Pecori Festival.
Yeah, me too.
Right, because we see another result of that is the massive green choo-choo.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure there's no monsters in Hyrule until that chest is opened.
Right, so Vati has gained the magical power of summoning benign enemies at Link sometimes.
I guess he can, like, shape malice, maybe? If my theory that what was in the chest was malice is true.
Which I think is solid.
Like, do you think he could also, like, he has Bokoblins and Lazalfos under his command? Like, he just hasn't gotten around to it yet?
I mean, if this moment is telling of anything, it's that, yeah, he could be doing this over and over again. We just have very few instances where we actually bump into Vati between now and the end of the game. But he could be populating all of the areas before we get to them.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was thinking. I don't think I have enough points of data to make, like, a red string conspiracy board that would link, like, Vati, Ganon, Demise, and Malice, like, all these different factors. You know what I mean?
I think Malice would be the link, the string in between most of them, though.
Yeah.
I don't think Malice would be its own picture on that board. I think it would be the connective tissue to a few
I guess other. I'm just thinking, because the fact that Vati can also make Moblins, which is, like, I guess not strictly tied to Ganon.
Why would any enemy be tied strictly to Ganon?
Because Ganon is usually, like, a pig, right? You got... Then again, Demise also had Moblins, right?
Yeah, Moblins were all over Skyward Sword. Moblins and Bokoblins were some of the main attractions.
Okay. So Ganon being a pig man is unrelated to Moblins and Bokoblins. That's what I'm picking up.
If Malice is any part of the curse that Demise placed on Link throughout mm-hmm. these centuries, if there's any bit of Malice in there, that little bit of Malice might be what is shaping many creatures throughout this timeline into those pigman forms. And that could be part of the reason why Ganon is a pigman when he joins the fray.
Could be. That could also be like a Sacred Realm, Dark World thing, because that turns anybody into animals. I'm getting super sidetracked, but, like,
okay,
I'll come back to this later, maybe as a bonus episode.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I just to briefly brush upon it, I think there might be a connection between Moblins and Bokoblins and Lazalfos being, like, sucked into Malice, along with Magma being turned into monsters. I think there's a through line there.
Oh, the Acrobandits.
Well, now they're Acrobandits, sure. But, like, I think there's something there, and I'm going to come back to this in the future.
Magmas deserved better.
They really don't, but go on.
We're going on over to the Western Wood now, where Ezlo has a little premonition. He says, "What a strange feeling. I sensed something from the castle's direction. Or was it just me?" And then we cut to a cutscene of the king in the castle with Zelda's, you know, standing near Zelda's statue. I guess he's just hanging out in this room with his daughter's statue. The king is weird in a lot of these games.
Yeah, so he's a weird dude. I'm not sure exactly what his motivation would be to have Princess Zelda in the courtroom. Because that's what this is, right? The throne room is like when people are at court, right?
I guess so. Maybe he just wants to watch over her himself to make sure nothing happens, nothing worse happens.
That's fair, I guess.
Vati teleports in and approaches the king.
Which he can just do.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's really kind of no limit to where he can teleport.
Because, like, the second Daltus gets up out of that throne to go drop a deuce or something, Vati just shadow warps behind him and stabs him in the back, and he's done.
I mean, that could be what he does. It doesn't seem like he has a thirst for blood in the same way that Girahim has.
Yeah, that's true.
Instead, Vati just approaches the king.
I'm going to turn you to stone so bad.
He approaches the king. The scene cuts out for a second with a menacing laugh. And then we go forward in time to the king without Vati there, standing with his royal guard. He says, "Ah, it looks like you're all here. Very well. The King of Hyrule has words for you. You all know of the power the Picori gave to mankind, do you not? The golden light force of limitless magical power. I want it. Go now and bring me this power. Fling anyone who refuses into the dungeon. Him and his family, too."
Anybody, any soldier who immediately does not, like, bat an eye at this and just follows their orders is not paying attention.
Hey, is there a recurring theme with the soldiers throughout this season of Hello Hyrule?
They're just
I think there is. It's that they're bad at their job.
They're just here for a paycheck.
They're just here for a paycheck? And this just furthers that. It just continues to labor that point.
Yeah, this seems... I completely and utterly trust you, new acting king, guy who does not act like the guy I've worked for a long time.
Yeah, like, there's no question of what's going on here. They would have been working for this king for a period of time. Like, we've seen enough of the king to know what's happening. It's bizarre that they don't.
And everyone knows what the Triforce is, right? It's on everything.
You would hope so. I mean, they don't even call it that, though. They just call it the Light Force.
It's on the windows. It's on the walls. If we could see the ceiling, it's probably drawn on the ceiling. Like... they know what he's talking about. And the fact that this guy starts acting through the king's body or with his face and saying, like, oh, yeah, that thing, that force light thing. Yeah, that.
Yeah, it's
we all know about it.
It's bizarre behavior. But you know what? It's a thing of all of the knights are too scared to speak up against it. So they all just go along with it. And we cut back to Ezlo, who says, huh, maybe it was just the wind. He tells us, according to the map, the next element shouldn't be too far.
I can't. It's mostly because Ezlo's an old man, but like that cutaway is like, did you hear something? I felt like a presence. It must have just been the wind. And that's like when he farts on your head.
Oh, it's just going to keep going back to Ezlo's digestive issues throughout the season with you.
What's this presence?
Presents or presents that he's leaving in Link's hair?
Well, that would be an accident, but yeah. Hopefully it's just the wind.
All right, so that's gonna wrap it up as far as some of the big story beats in this episode that we're gonna talk about, but we are gonna move on to a little bit of a Kinstone corner, which I think is becoming less specifically about Kinstone quests and more about just Kinstone quests and side quests. This is just like, hey, a lot of little stuff happens between these dungeons, and this is just a good place for us to talk about some of them. We're not going to talk about every Kinstone quest. We're going to talk about the interesting ones.
I think most of Kinstone fusions that you can do are not even quests. Like, you trade with a random NPC, and then, like, you see a shot of a tree that's fallen down going back up again.
That's fair enough.
And that's about it. Like, it's not really a quest.
Listen, there are some Kinstone defenders out there. I'm just trying to push back a little bit for them. I may not be one of them myself, but there's some cool things about it, I guess.
I will fight to the hilt for Kinstones, Chris, but I just don't think they're all that interesting in this game, you know?
Right. So let's talk about some of the most interesting ones at this point. Let's go back to Lon Lon Ranch for a second here.
Great.
So we go back to Lon Lon Ranch at this point, or really any point after Mount Krennel, and we could talk to Malin and Talon outside of their ranch.
Yep.
Talon tells you he lost his key to get into the ranch. We can transform in a tree stump nearby, enter the ranch, and break a pot to find a spare key. We bring it back outside, and Talon thanks us for finding his spare key, and he tells us if we ever need to go to Lake Hylia, we can cut through his ranch. You can also talk to Malin here, and something cute about Malin is she, when you talk to her, she thanks you in text, but you can hear the little bit of Lon Lon Ranch that is a Ponus theme.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a cute little touch.
That's extremely cute.
Let's talk about these characters for a second, because I know we kind of didn't touch on them last time we were in Lon Lon Ranch.
I mean, Malin... if you played Ocarina of Time, you know Malin. She's basically the same character.
Yeah, these are the N64 sprites in 2D form, which I love.
Including, later, you'll see Epona.
Yeah, which, I was excited. I have that note later, yeah.
I guess it's not really Epona, though, because it's not your horse. You don't name it.
Okay, but the fact that she plays the notes from Epona's theme and you see that horse later.
That's fair.
It might as well be.
You can say it's Epona's theme, but like if you name the horse like Biscuit, then it'll be Biscuit's theme.
Biscuit's theme. One of the top three Zelda tracks of all time, Biscuits Theme. In Lon Lon Ranch, we can also use the cane to find a new exit up north to Vale Falls, which we can't do much with yet, but there is a heart piece. We can fuse Kinstones with the Goron down here that's punching through the cave in Lon Lon Ranch.
Right, and that's what gets a Goron to move to town in Hyrule Town. He'll go to the marketplace at the center.
Mm-hmm. The Goron merchant then moves into Hyrule Town when you fuse with this Goron.
Which, how does that benefit him?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I think clearly there is a familial through line to all these Gorons.
Oh, that's his cousin.
Right, so one Goron having their business prosper helps the other Gorons as well.
That's fair. That's honestly a pretty good point.
Pete, I'm stretching, man. I don't know. I got lucky there.
No, I dig it. I dig it. Like, stuff for the Goron community is good for all Gorons.
Anyway, at this point, we have the Goron businessman in Hyrule Town, and also Malin will likely be visiting Hyrule Town. So maybe this is where we should have our Hyrule business highlight for today.
Okay, so you mentioned Malin coming to town. I don't think that's connected to anything Kinstone related at all.
But I do think it has to happen after you open the ranch.
That's fair. I mean, just to address Malin really quick, because she's not necessarily part of the part of town.
Right. She's not part of the specific thing we're talking about for the highlight today.
Right. Sure. She is a local business, but I don't think there's enough there to have a whole highlight.
No. Basically, you can find Malin in Hyrule Town selling Lon Lon milk.
Yep. Out of a little cart.
Out of a little cart dragged by a horse, which, as Pete mentioned, very well may be our first Epona.
Mm-hmm.
This milk is 100 rupees. It replenishes health. It does the job well. And I think you get multiple uses for one jar of it.
Yeah, you get two.
I think I used it once, but most of the time I was just stuffing fairies in there.
I think it heals you and also it might increase your strength temporarily. I could be wrong. There's so many different iterations of milk in this franchise, Chris, it drives me up a wall. And I only say that because I'm trying to make a tabletop RPG.
See, I love that you're thinking about it to the extent where milk is an item in your tabletop RPGs. That, mm-hmm. that makes me excited to see the final product because those little details are very important.
But in any case, you can buy that from her and that's kind of your whole interaction with Melon. Mm-hmm. You can trade kinstones with her at some point, but I don't think you get anything super substantial.
Yes, she is one of the random kinstone fusion traders. So it's I think green kinstones, and they will likely just make a treasure chest appear somewhere with rupees or whatever.
Yeah.
But our Hyrule business highlight for today is the town square in Hyrule Town.
Right. Hyrule Town Square.
Hyrule Town Square. We're not doing the traditional sponsorship today because there are four different vendors, and honestly,
episode 6, traditional.
I mean, hey, it's an aesthetic. The people love it. They are dying to hear more bits.
No bits today.
No bits today. We don't really have one. There are four different vendors, and we just want to talk about them.
Yeah, there's four different little stalls here. Well, I say stalls, but they're four different rugs.
They are blankets. We've talked about them multiple times now. We cleaned one off a few episodes ago.
Identically designed rugs/blankets, which kind of suggests they are provided by the town, which is kind of nice.
I guess so. I mean, the fact that they're identical means that there had to be one person coming up with that decision, so I'd like to think it's the mayor of Hyrule. I have a note about these four. I call them the four horsemen of the useless Stacopolis.
Is that a dinosaur, Chris?
Stacopolis? It was, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I really didn't use any of these four vendors. I mean, you only can use two of them.
You can only use two. You can really only get use out of one, and that is a stretch.
Yeah, but doing research for this episode, I think they are a little bit cooler than I was giving them credit for.
I think I agree with that.
You don't really need to use it. It's kind of like the milk situation. You don't need to use it, so like you have to kind of go out of your way to use it. Anyway, who are they? You got Brocco. You got Pina. Uh-huh. You got our boy Beatles back.
Yeah, boy.
And you got... Who's the fourth one?
The fourth one is the Goron merchant that sells
the Kinstones. The Goron merchant. Right.
It was the whole through line, Chris, into this segment.
So let's talk about the more useless of the two first.
Well, you say useless, Chris. They sell very important produce and vegetables.
Yeah, you got Brocco, who's a vegetable vendor. Brocco, who I guess is named because his head or hat looks like a stick of broccoli.
Could be one way or the other. Maybe he decided to look like that later.
Oh, it's another hat thing. He lives in the middle of Hyrule Town, where he runs a shop selling vegetables. He's very passionate about his business and talks about how veggies contribute to a balanced diet.
He, well, according to his figurine description, though, like, he and Pina are constantly fighting over whether or not vegetables have health benefits. What a way to spend your day, huh?
It also says something about Pina.
In that she believes... Oh, yeah, good point.
Right? Pina is the coworker who bickers with your vegetarian coworker and talks every day to them about how they have a nice steak dinner waiting for them at home.
Oh, here's the thing. I don't think they're coworkers. I think they are rivals.
Oh, are they rivals?
I think so, because they're constantly arguing about it. And also, he says at some point that, like, his mom will be angry at him if he doesn't sell his vegetables, and, like, more so if he dares to trade his vegetables for fruits.
Right. I guess I was giving the short end of the stick to Pina. Pina's not a meat eater necessarily. She's the fruit vendor, so...
I have my own thoughts about Pina, like, from episode one of this season, where the figurine guy whose name is... Karlov?
Right.
Where Karlov, in her figurine description, calls Pina a freak, which...
What?
Yeah.
Do you have that figurine description?
I read it in the first episode. Yeah, let me grab it. Karlov's description of Pina. Hyrule's fruit vendor. She hates vegetables. There's point number one. So she won't even sell tomatoes, even though they technically are fruits. Freak.
Wait, it says freak at the end?
It says freak.
Wow, Karlov, I like it. People don't like... There are people out there who don't like vegetables. It's the reality of the world. But for people to passionately dislike vegetables, but passionately love fruit is an interesting... Little twist.
I mean, fruit is the more fun thing, right? It's like the dessert of vegetables.
It's the more sugary version of, yeah. But I don't know.
Like, you tell me, Chris, when you were a little kid, would you rather have eaten, like, a banana or, like, steamed broccoli? What was the thing you'd go to?
Oh, banana, without a doubt.
Yeah, come on.
Oh, yeah, no. Fruit are the tastier treats, without a doubt. It's just to look down on vegetables when your whole thing is the junk food of healthy food.
As a grown adult, yeah, I think that is a problem. Although, I mean, unless it has something to do with, like, this whole business rivalry these two have.
I guess so. I feel like, though, when you're going fruit or vegetable shopping, you're getting a little column A, you're getting a little column B. It's not like, oh, I doubled down on apples today, so I just have no room for lettuce. I don't know. It's a little weird. You can't really do much with either of them. You can do Kinstone fusions with Brocco, but it's random Kinstone fusions, as well as Pina. I think they both have random Kinstone fusions.
Right.
Let's talk about Beetle for a second.
Beetle, I love this dude. The more that I think about how he's in, like, more games than he's not at this point, I think.
Yeah. Beatles have more games than Ganondorf, right?
Actually, yeah. When you say it like that.
He might be. I don't know. I haven't actually counted, but I see 6 in the wiki page right here, so it's not too bad.
I mean, oh boy. Okay, well, if you clean up Pina's mess from the Pickery Festival, then Beetle will show up in that spot.
He's the clean freak that we mentioned in the previous episode.
Right. Beetle shows up with several bottles stacked around him that sell something called Picolite.
Mm-hmm. These are items that are only in this game.
Only in this game. It is a glowing flower nectar, which Chris... He steals.
What makes you say that?
Because the source of Picolite is one place, and that is in the barrel building in Minish Village.
But how does he... Hurdy-gurdy man.
What? Wait, what? What about the hurdy-gurdy man?
I mean, how else is he getting into Minish Village? He has to have a guy on the inside.
Oh, I was thinking that, like, he would just open the barrel he found in the woods and take it.
No. This is much more interesting. Because in that scenario, Beetle is haplessly walking over Minish Village in a way that makes me very scared.
And that he's kind of an adult. He wouldn't even see it. He'd just see a barrel full of glowing flowers.
Okay, that's possible. I like the hurdy-gurdy man being a man on the inside, working with him and bringing him some of these.
I mean, I do like the idea that there's consent involved. That's pretty good.
So what are picolites?
Picolite is, as I mentioned, the nectar of pico flowers or pico blooms that are grown in Minish Village. It was the barrel building you went in to get the jabber nut towards the start of the game, where you find all these different unbloomed flowers that are lining this in the interior of this building. There are two colors in this building at the start of the game, which are the same two colors of picolite that Beetle has at his stall when he first comes in. He gets more picolite in his wares as you return to Minish Village to help the farmers in that barrel grow more colors of pico blooms or pico blossoms.
Wait, really?
Yeah, really.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. There's a farmer Minish, which is visually indistinct from other ones, who will ask you for different materials, such as like Lon Lon milk or a red potion or Mount Krennel mineral water. And you'll bring that to him, and that will help him grow a new color of pico blooms.
And once that grows, the shop updates at Beetle's?
Right away.
That's amazing. I had no idea about that.
It's pretty cool. I used them a little bit and I was done with that. There's like, what, 5 or 6 different colors of picolite, and they all have different effects, and they all only last like 10 seconds, so they're not worth the price.
Wait, 10 seconds? Really?
When I used them.
Okay, so let's talk about what these actually do. Basically, you use a picolite, and for a period of time, you find more of a specific item out in the wild for a period of time.
Yeah.
So let's say you find yourself needing hearts or rupees or kinstone pieces.
Right.
Or, you know, mysterious shells. Maybe you're trying to collect the last few figurines.
Brother, do not rely on picolite for mysterious shells. That is, you will devour all of your money and you'll just be in a vicious cycle of cutting grass to try and get mysterious shells.
We have blue picolite, which gets you arrows and bombs, green, which gets you mysterious shells, red for recovery hearts, orange for fairies, that's cool, yellow for rupees, and white for kinstone pieces.
Right.
Okay, not too bad. Not terribly necessary. It's kind of like potions in Skyward Sword. Nice that they're there. Maybe in a scenario or two, you could find a good use of them, but really not needed.
Ultimately, not that necessary. And I'm looking at a description. It says they last 30 seconds, or approximately 30 seconds, it says on the Zelda Wiki here.
You gotta do, like, a lot of cutting in that 30 seconds. That doesn't seem like nearly enough time.
Well, you get some moves later on that let you, like, whirling dervish your way through some weeds if you need it. But, like, even 30 seconds, which I will contest that it is 30 seconds. It's very short. During that time, you're not going to get a lot, because even the increased percentage of stuff you find isn't that great.
Yeah, sure.
Like, this could have been really helpful. They just, you know, up the numbers a little bit, but they decided to keep it a little more tame.
Yeah, it should have been like 5 to 10 minutes, to be honest with you. Thinking about like this mysterious shell. No, I say 5 minutes. I'm standing by it. When you think about kinstone pieces or mysterious shells.
Ooh, mysterious shells, yeah.
It's like at the end, sometimes you just want to clean up some of the more tedious elements of the game. Maybe make those two more expensive, but make it longer.
Yeah, exactly. Because they all cost just 200 rupees.
Yeah, that's a little bit weird.
Yeah, that makes sense. Make the one for like fairies or kinstones, make it cost a little more. But for mysterious shells, make it like the cheapest one and make it last 5 minutes.
Yeah. Anything else about Beetle before we push on to the last merchant?
Well, I think the only thing I can say is that I appreciate you put the thought out there that he is not a malicious thief. I like that.
I appreciate the fact that you connected the dots for this business interacting with Minish Village in that way, because I had no idea of that. That's super cool.
Oh, yeah.
It is nice to see him here in this 2D capacity. It was fun to see him.
Not a lot here. I mean, for the fact that most characters in this 2D game don't get a lot of personification, you know? So it adds up.
And last but not least, the Goron Merchant appears after that Kinstone fusion with the Goron Digger. And essentially, he is a Kinstone merchant.
Don't buy from him.
You talk about, though, competing shops in the town square. Mm-hmm. This and Beetle should be competing, because why would you spend 200 rupees on a Picolite with Beetle for Kinstones when you can just cut the middleman, go to this merchant, spend 50 or 200 and just get the Kinstone? You could just have it.
Or make that a three-way feud, Chris. Go across the way to the bakery and buy a piece of cake.
Oh, that's the frugal way to go about it. Yeah, so he sells you green Kinstones for 50 rupees, blue Kinstones for 200, and red Kinstones for 300 rupees. That kind of makes sense, considering the green Kinstones are the random ones, essentially, and the red ones are the more plot-heavy Kinstone fusions.
Well, more than that, Chris, in the next episode, we're going somewhere where green Kinstones are a dime a dozen. They are everywhere. My dude.
Absolutely.
But red and blue, I can understand. They're, you know, maybe you're missing a particular shape of that color that you'd need. Here's the thing. The shape of the Kinstone piece you buy is random.
Oh, yeah. So it's like, what color and what shape?
And Chris, he doesn't replenish his stores until you buy all three.
Oh, no. I don't like that.
Do not buy from this man.
That's bad business. What I will say to his credit is he's got a very cute blue hat.
He does. I like his hat a lot. His little Gilligan hat. It's pretty good.
Anything else about these four merchants before we push forward?
I hope they're friends. I know that Bracco and Pina have their own little feud going on, but I hope it's not overblown.
I think everyone's going to be just fine. And on that note,
step back into the Kinstone corner.
To step back into a corner is like a weird way.
It's,
like,
yeah, it is a little weird, huh?
Especially like multiple people.
It's a little like...
Hey, bud, thanks for coming by. You want to come with me over to the corner?
It's a little Blair Witch. I'm not a fan of that. Okay.
That's what I was thinking. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Anyway, we can fuse Kinstones with one of the farmers out in Lon Lon Ranch, Eni and Meenie, the human farmers that you mentioned earlier.
That's probably where Bracco gets his stuff.
That's probably where he gets his stuff. It sparks something in that punchy Goron that makes him feel much stronger and punch through the cavern wall. You can go in and follow him here, but essentially you need to keep doing Kinstone fusions, which will keep bringing new Goron along to punch further through this cave.
Kinstone fusions, Chris, that you have to perform with walls. It's only with walls that you have to find inside of like little dug caverns.
It's so weird. We'll talk about the rest of this maybe at a later Kinstone corner.
Yeah, because like it involves locations that we haven't been to yet, so we might want to, you know.
Yeah, but a location that we have been to, this cave that he's punching into, did you notice that it's just a bunch of Goron heads on the ground outside of this cave?
I did.
What?
Why? I'm not sure. It could be this is like an old Goron location that caved in. Or something. That's the best I can figure.
Are those the Goron that are going to assist him? Like, are they coming out of the ground there and then going in to assist him as this quest goes on?
Wait. Are you positing that the Skyward Sword manga is canon? Because that's what happened, right?
What?
That they came out of the earth?
I just don't understand why their heads are just poking out of the ground here. It's weird and macabre.
Their heads? You mean the statues? They're statues.
Outside of the cave?
Yeah, it's statues, Chris.
Oh, so is this some kind of weird Goron sanctuary?
That's what I was saying, yeah. Wait, okay. You thought these were like...
Oh, okay. Listen, let's talk about the very normal thing to do to just have a bunch of statues of disembodied heads outside of a cave.
If they all kind of look similar, then I guess maybe, I don't know.
It's weird. It's serial killer behavior.
I don't get Goron culture.
Here's the hand wave again. It's just something weird to
notice. It's definitely just a statue, though. It's not like a dead Goron, Chris.
Okay. I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying you see a head there. Anyway. Moving on to a few other smaller ones, there is one instance in Eastern Hills where we can use Pachi's cane to find another secret entrance into Minish Woods, which leads us to another great fairy fountain, the second.
Oh, okay, great.
We have a yellow version of the great fairy that we met in Mount Krennel.
Oh, yeah, no, this is the great butterfly fairy.
That makes sense, visually. This one says she needs many rupees right now, and she asks us to throw all our rupees into the spring. If we agree and affirm that we understand what we're doing to her, she says that we are most kind, and she doesn't really need our rupees, and she must reward our kindness with some of her power.
I mean, here's the thing. This is a similar thing to the Great Fairy in Mount Krennel, where you are honest or, you know, in this case, considerate, right?
But I like that one because it's like at least after an Aesop fable, kind of. Mm-hmm. Like this one's just like she's lying to you. And if you go along with it, she's like, you're good. Here's a big wallet. It's my power. I'm the capitalist butterfly. Here's a big wallet. My power.
Yeah. Essentially, I would say you're buying it, but you get your rupees back.
I don't think you ever actually give her your rupees,
right?
I think she's just like, oh, you really were gonna do that.
So this one feels a little more like I know what's going on now, like, which I guess I'm projecting this onto Link, but like this great fairy says, give me your rupees. I'm like, okay, what do I get for this? And like, okay, here you go. I'm being kind. Wink. You know, but I know I'm actually getting something.
Which, I mean, again, it's a cool trick the first time you use it, but the second time it's just kind of less effective.
Uh-huh.
That being said, the reward itself, I'll take a bigger wallet over more bombs
any day.
Any Zelda game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I like that quote-unquote fairy power.
Purchasing power.
Yeah. And that really is the gamut, I think, of kinstones that are worth talking about in this episode up to this point.
I mean, yeah, there's a bunch.
Except.
Oh.
Stop. It's tingle time. Huh? Yo.
Gruding. Yay! Oh, no. This is our first encounter in the timeline with Tingle, right? Because at first in Skyward Sword, it was just a doll that Zelda had made.
Yes, we are aware of the demigod Tingle who has existed way before we ever have and will exist way after us because of the little knit doll in Zelda's room of Skyward Sword.
Now hang on, Chris. Are you believing that there's only ever one Tingle?
No. I'm having these thoughts in real time. I'm realizing, no, because Tingle has family in some of these games, right?
Yeah, and the family changes by game.
So Tingle is the same as Link, is the same as Zelda, is the same as Ganon.
Kind of, yeah. And I mean,
it's the same as Beetle.
And I have a theory about that, Chris. And I'm wondering if we have time for me to share that here.
Yes. Before you get into your theory, let me talk about his dialogue for a second.
Okay.
He says, that green cap and green clothes, are you perhaps a fairy? Oh, I knew it. Tingle wants to be a fairy too. Actually, Tingle has some kinstones, you know? And I have given kinstones to my brothers too. If you confuse kinstones with me and each of my brothers, well, I don't want to give it away, but you'll get something very, very good. Oh. Good luck, Mr. Fairy.
Okay. I will not play into the internet tropes about Tingle. Not gonna do it.
No, Tingle's just an excited man.
Yes, he's a fairy enthusiast and the Wario of the Zelda franchise.
He is a meme character, sure, but yeah. He's a meme character because he's a fun design, and
yeah,
every appearance he makes is different.
Mm-hmm.
And completely kind of out of left field.
I just want to say, those of you who are hard on Tingle, he didn't get his own games for nothing.
So you had a theory about Tingle that you wanted to posit?
I do. So the first time we ever, you know, get a whiff of Tingle in the Zelda timeline is in Skyward Sword, in Zelda's room as a crocheted doll that Zelda supposedly made.
Okay.
Okay. My theory is that the original Tingle was just a story, like a folk legend, right? Or like a nursery rhyme that people like in Skyloft, okay?
Sure.
And then just by happenstance, Zelda becoming the goddess of the world, right?
Okay.
That kind of accidentally put some kind of spin on Tingle to make him a reoccurring real person.
So I like this. Could it be that, or could it be when Zelda got wrapped up and entangled in Demise's curse, things about Zelda, things that are tangential to Zelda, also kind of became doomed to recur, which is why you see Gaipora come back as Roru. You see Tingle come back as a adult man.
Oh, so like everybody.
Everybody. This is like, you know, when a superhero gets a superpower, it's not just about that superhero, it's about the people in their life.
Whoa, Chris, you just blew this whole franchise wide open. So like
that one just came to the dome.
So like everybody that reoccurs, Beetle included, you know, reoccurs in time.
It's all Demise, baby.
Because, wow.
I don't know.
But like what I'm positing is that Tingle is reoccurring every few generations, like Link and Zelda and Ganon are, because of, you know, timey-wimey goddess stuff that happened after Zelda made the doll.
Yeah.
Zelda liked Tingle before she was a goddess. So this whole thing kind of like, you know, bends over on itself and overlays to where Tingle is now a reoccurring real folk character that appears in history.
Either of those theories, I would be excited to see come into a deeper fruition. We never see any other character really interact directly with Tingle outside of his family, right?
The only other person that I can think of that even talks about him is his dad in Majora's Mask, who calls him like a lazy boy.
Right, right. And you've got his cousins in this game who we'll get to at a future Kinstone Corner.
Right. But in any case, that is my theory, up and down.
I love it. I genuinely am excited about it. I'm glad that we got another one of those in. Tingle, we can Kinstone fuse with Tingle. Tingle has the best Kinstone animation. Every character, when you do a Kinstone fusion, there's like a Kinstone fusion screen with like an almost static image of Link and that character.
Right.
Tingle is having a field day on this screen.
Is
he
really?
Is partying. He's doing cartwheels. There's confetti everywhere. It's a blast.
He's a fun character.
He's a great character. This was the point. So I fused Kinstones with Tingle. It opens a door in like North Hyrule Field. There's going to be four of these that need to be open. We'll talk about it in another episode.
Mm-hmm.
After you do this, though, you can talk to Tingle and he'll tell you how many non-random Kinstone fusions are left in the game.
Uh-huh.
At this point, I had 97 left to fuse.
Whoa. Okay.
I literally have in my notes the words, oh.
Yeah, there's a lot of fusions, man. There's a lot. A detail that might help with that, though, make sure that when you fuse Kinstones with Tingle and his cousins, you do so at least twice. They have multiple.
Good thing to note.
Yep. There's a lot of characters that let you fuse multiple times. You gotta make sure each time that you go to somebody.
So I guess it's time for us to step back from the Kinstone Corner and make our way over to the post office, I think.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah!
All right, so I'm going to take this first one here from Linky, who says, hey, I love your podcast, and I've been playing Minish Cap, and so far, I love your Minish Cap season. I like that so far there, because we could screw this up at any point, let's be very honest.
I mean, the sheer amount of theories in this episode could completely turn Linky the other way.
Linky, I hope you're still with us. I hope you're still having a good time. Thank you for writing in. And yeah, thanks for playing along with us. It's so cool to me to think that people might be playing along with us.
Like, thanks a lot for that, really. It's a nice, short, sweet email.
Do you want to take this next email from Noah?
Sure. So Noah says, thank you so much for the amazing podcast. I listen to it every day. I love the Legend of Zelda franchise, and I love talking about it. Your segments are hilarious, and you guys clearly know your Zelda.
Clearly? Wow.
We're winging it. We're winging it, Noah, real hard.
That's another one where it's just, I'm glad you feel that way right now. I hope we have not ruined it by the end of this episode.
Noah then goes on to ask us, what's our favorite Legend of Zelda game?
And he says one other thing. Do you want to read the last thing he says? Because I think it's important to this.
He says, if it's not Ocarina of Time, I will sick a Glirok on you.
Well, I guess I'm in luck because a Glirok is a very cool looking thing that I would love to see in real life. And Ocarina of Time is not my favorite Legend of Zelda game, though I respect what it did.
Bring them on, Noah. Bring the Gleeroks.
Listen. Ocarina of Time's incredible. It's incredible for doing the same thing Mario 64 did. It took a 2D franchise and made it 3D in a way that felt natural to the franchise. It's incredible.
For sure.
I'm playing through it again on the Switch right now, actually, very slowly.
You are?
Yeah, yeah. It's on the Switch expansion pass. Anyway, my favorite Legend of Zelda game is not Ocarina of Time. It is Link to the Past. It's the game I grew up with.
Right.
It was, to me, I'll never forget, like, the feeling of, oh, wow, there is a consistent world here. You know, like, it's not like Mario World or Donkey Kong Country where there's a map and you're entering a level-by-level basis.
Right.
Link to the Past, when I was a kid, was very much, oh, these characters are on the map all the time.
Yeah.
And if I go into that cave and then leave that cave, those characters might be doing something different.
It was like the Skyrim of the day, right?
For sure. And the thing that I am so passionate about with the Zelda series is I feel like you can make that argument for any game in this franchise, really. And it's so cool that different generations can point to most Zelda games and be like, yeah, that game did that for me. Mm-hmm. Wind Waker did that for me.
Yep.
Twilight Princess did that for me. You know, for me, it just happened to be Link to the Past. I'm not saying Link to the Past is the best Zelda game. It's definitely not. But I just have such a nostalgia for Link to the Past.
Now, this sensation that you're describing, Chris, my favorite Zelda game actually does. Majora's Mask, baby!
Uh-huh. And why is it your favorite?
Well, I mean, similar to you, it was my first Zelda game, and I played it in elementary school. Everybody's first Zelda game that they play, especially if they play it as a little tiny baby, that's going to be their favorite.
Oh, yeah.
And for me, it was Majora's Mask. Which, what you were describing for Link to the Past is exactly how I feel about Majora's Mask. Apart from all the other stuff that I love about it, and that it's, like gritty and darker and, like, a little insidious on the background.
Oh, yeah.
That world feels so lived in. Like, everybody has personalities. Everybody has a schedule throughout their day.
I think that's what makes this a particularly good Zelda game to talk about with that mechanic is like, yeah, this, they are doing something every hour of that game.
Yep. They have lives that they're living. It's really good.
Majora's Mask is an incredible game. It's by all means a more stressful Zelda game. It 100% is probably the most stressful Zelda game. Anyway, thank you, Noah. I always love when people ask us a question in postcards.
Yeah, same.
And I'm sorry that neither of us said Ocarina of Time. Ocarina is a truly magnificent and important game that is just happens to not be either of our favorites.
It is a great game, but I'm not sorry.
I am so sorry. And I'm sorry for Pete's behavior as well here. Anyway, I will take this last email from Aaron. Aaron says, hey guys, I'm greatly enjoying the podcast. You inspired me to finally get back to playing Skyward Sword, and while I've never played Minish Cap, although my wife and five-year-old have both played it, I'm enjoying learning more about it and how it relates to other Legend of Zelda games. My five-year-old even listens with me sometimes. Oh my gosh.
Ooh, I like that.
Aaron, if you're listening right now with your five-year-old, hey Aaron, hey little Aaron, I hope you've been enjoying this episode.
I'm glad that we're really on the ball with the censoring then.
yeah, we're doing it for you guys. I love the soundtrack, and it's total coincidence that I recently released a cover of Peace Returns from Minish Cap. I only wish it was possible to license more songs from this game. Keep up the good work, and I'm not going to say this last part.
You have to. You have to say it, Chris. It's in all caps. You have to say it.
He says, excuse me, podcasters. Anyway, we know Aaron through some brief interactions on Twitter, so we know that this is Aaron Grubb.
Very cool dude.
He puts out a ton of Zelda music, so, and this isn't an ad or anything, but honestly, personally, I can recommend going and checking out Aaron. You can find his music by searching Aaron Grubb Music.
Yeah.
In YouTube and Spotify, that's where I've done it, and probably on Apple Music as well. That's two A's at the start, two B's at the end. And maybe I'll just put like a 5 seconds of his song behind some of this.
Heck yeah.
Thank you for writing in, Aaron. Anyway, I think that's going to wrap up the postcards for this episode. And if people want to write in and tell us what kind of boss enemy they will sic on us for our bad opinions, where can they do that?
If you want to send us a postcard, you can either shoot us an email over at hyrlepod@gmail.com, or you can drop us a rating and review over on Apple Podcasts. We'll read your messages here on the show. Just a small little kickback for us. Your ratings and reviews actually make it easier for more people like you to find this show.
Yeah, we greatly appreciate it. It helps us out big time, and we'll read them out on the show. So, you know, it goes both ways a little bit.
If you want to find the show on social, you can find us on Twitter, Insta, and Tumblr at Hyrule Pod.
Yeah.
If you want to find us individually, you can find me on Twitter at The Edge of My Pete.
And I am at a man named Babs, B-A-B-S.
And I think that's going to do it for this episode of Hello Hyrule. Thank you for listening. Next episode, we're jumping into the Caster Wilds. But until then, I have been Pete.
And I've been Chris.
Excuse me, podcast.